We have with us live in the studios once again, Joff Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with the State. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right, plenty to cover this week, as there always is, starting out with local and developments this week in the Washington State Senate.
Yeah, this week the gay marriage bill got its 25th vote in the Senate. Of course, it hasn't come to a floor vote yet, but it did make it out of the Senate committee without all of the amendments that the Republicans tried to tack onto it. And it looks like it will eventually pass both the Senate and the House and go to the governor for signature. And she has said that she will sign it.
Now it takes 25 votes in order to pass in the Senate. And 25 senators now have publicly committed to passing it. And there was already the number that had committed to approving it in the House. And Gregoire has already said she would sign it. So it looks like a sure thing at this point. However, there's also already a conservative group that is mounting a signature drive campaign to try and take that prospective law onto the ballot next November as a referendum.
The referendum can't be filed until the governor's actually signed the bill. And then signers will have 90 days from the end of the legislative session on March 8th in order to collect about 120,000 signatures. Yeah. So a little bit of a steep curve there. But it depends on who's behind it and how much money they have to pay signature gatherers.
One of the other things that was notable this week about the gay marriage issue was that Attorney General Rob McKenna, who, of course, is the almost certain Republican nominee for governor, very quietly came out against gay marriage this week. He's been trying in his race for governor to present himself as the agreeable moderate Republican, you know, not like those other nasty guys out there, but his record as attorney general has really been anything but that in a lot of different ways. Been very, very, a lot of dog whistles, as they mentioned on Counterspin. And this is the case in this arena also, where he came out against it, but, because, so much of the media, particularly the Seattle Times here in Seattle, is so friendly toward McKenna, it was very soft-pedaled, and people don't really realize that socially McKenna is extremely conservative and will probably campaign against gay marriage this summer and fall.
Yeah, and I just want to point out, too, that the 25th vote committed in the Senate to passing the gay marriage bill was Senator Mary Margaret Hagan, and she's a Democrat from Kamano Island, but she's a conservative Democrat, and she's been against gay marriage for many, many years. And she made a complete turnabout. And I just want to read a quote from her that was quoted in one of the news reports. She said, "I have very strong Christian beliefs, and personally, I have always said when I accepted the Lord, I became more tolerant of others. I stopped judging people and try to live by the golden rule." And then she goes on to say, "For as long as I've been alive, living in my country has been about having the freedom to live according to our own personal and religious beliefs and having people respect that freedom." And I just want to say that I thank her for saying that and for pointing that out. And I hope that folks who have been opposed to gay marriage in Washington really think about what she said, because I think what she said is in the true spirit of Christianity.
Yeah, and the 24th vote that committed last week, Jim Castanet, is a Republican from Puyallup. And so it goes to show that the support for this is to some extent bipartisan as well. It really is a civil rights issue rather than a social or religious issue. Uh-huh. And it really is kind of sad that the civil rights of a particular class of people is going to be put up to popular vote, which appears to be the direction that we're going. But the good news for that is that polling, at least current polling, shows the majority of Washingtonians are in favor of gay marriage. It's something that would have been unthinkable 10 years ago. So it's very much a positive turn of events and a positive day for Washington State. We are likely to become the 7th state in the country that will legalize gay marriage.
Mm-hmm. All right. Moving on, Initiative 502.
Yeah, Initiative 502 made the ballot this week. That's the initiative to legalize marijuana. It would license and regulate marijuana under the State Liquor Control Board. It could be sold to anyone over 21 in stores that are dedicated to selling marijuana only. It would impose a 25% excise tax on both wholesale and retail sales of marijuana. And that income would go partially to the general fund and partially to drug prevention programs. But as Java's pointed out on other shows, that it also includes a provision for driving under the influence that sets a blood THC limit that many medical marijuana patients and advocates have complained is far too low for people who regularly use the drug.
Not too low, but also not a significant indicator of actual impairment.
Yeah.
So, again, that's another issue, as with gay marriage, where popular opinion is running way ahead of the so-called leadership of elected officials. And in this case, the legislature had the option, rather than taking the signatures, the 335,000 signatures that have been submitted in December by New Approach Washington, they could either have referred that to the ballot in November, or they could have straight out passed it into law, and they elected to go to the ballot rather than passing it themselves.
Yeah, and unlike gay marriage, which has never passed a public vote in any state in the union. In fact, it's in the other states where it's passed. It's always been a legislative bill that has passed,
or a court decision.
Or a court decision. Medical marijuana has passed many times, and there's a lot of popular support for it. So it could very well pass as a ballot initiative in the state of Washington.
Well, it'll be interesting to see what outside funding comes in on that.
Yeah, it will be, if any outside funding comes from opponents to legalizing marijuana.
All right. Moving on, a suit dealing with the National Marine Fisheries Services.
Yeah, this week environmental groups and Native American tribes brought a lawsuit against the National Marine Fisheries Service to try to halt the Navy's expanded use of sonar in exercises off the coasts of Washington, Oregon, and Northern California. The Navy uses the Northwest Training Range Complex. That's about 126,000 square miles from the coast of Northern California clear up to the Canadian border. They've been using that area to do exercises for some 60, 65 years since the end of World War II. But they've been asking the National Marine Fisheries Service to approve the expanded use of sonar. And the National Marine Fisheries Service, even though sonar has been proven to harm marine mammals and in some instances have killed whales and other creatures, the National Marine Fisheries Service, whose task is partially to oversee the health of those marine mammal stocks, they went ahead and gave the Navy the okay and said, yes, well, all you have to do before you use the sonar is just look around and see if you see any marine mammals in the vicinity. Otherwise, you're free to go ahead and use it. Well, these environmental groups and the native tribes said, look, you know, this area is a vast area, and it includes the breeding and the feeding grounds for many marine mammal species, as well as other marine life that's harmed by sonar. And, you know, this is not sufficient. The National Marine Fisheries Service, they need to study the impact of sonar on these populations, and they need to at least designate areas that the Navy needs to stay out of with this equipment. Of course, the Navy says that it wants to expand its use of sonar so that it can test weapons that it hasn't been able to test and do other kinds of training there. And you have to ask why, in an age of unmanned aerial drones, aerial bombing, and satellite surveillance, why we even need naval weaponry anymore. And of course, the answer to that is that the Navy's being deployed in order to intimidate some of our rivals like Russia and North Korea. Still,
China.
And China, even though the Cold War is long over.
All right. Moving on to national, starting out with some court rulings this week.
Yeah, a number of different developments this week showing pretty much the full range of what justice looks like in America in 2012. First of all, we had the Department of Justice under the Obama administration charging ex-CIA agent John Kirkyadow with 4 felonies, including 2 counts of treason under the Espionage Act of 1917 for telling reporters that, yes, the CIA, when Kirkyadow was an agent, did in fact torture torture people after 9/11. Now, this is, you would not think, particularly secret information at this point, but it was considered a state secret, and Kirkydow thus becomes the sixth person under the Obama administration to be charged with treason. That's when only three people had been charged under the Espionage Act in previous United States history. So the Obama administration being very, very aggressive, as it has been with all whistleblowers, in charging people essentially talking about what went on under the Bush administration and the years after 9/11 and with the invasion of Iraq. At the same time, another name from that era was back in the news this week, Jose Padilla, who was a United States citizen who was held incommunicado as an enemy combatant for several years. He had a lawsuit against Donald Rumsfeld and other Bush administration officials for torture. That lawsuit was dismissed this week in a federal court in Virginia. The court ruling that the lawsuit could not proceed because doing so would reveal state secrets. And then finally, Marine Staff Sergeant Frank Wooderich was the on-site commander for the Haditha massacre in Iraq in 2005. People may remember back in those days that in Haditha, 24 Iraqi civilians were murdered by U.S. armed forces in that city in Iraq. And Wooderich had been the highest ranking official to be put on trial and the last official to be put on trial for that. A lot of armed forces observers thinking that he was being made the scapegoat for higher ranking officials who had not been prosecuted. He was originally charged with murder. That had been reduced to manslaughter. And this week, Wooderich pled out to negligent dereliction of duty for basically time served. That's his penalty for overseeing the murder of 24 Iraqi civilians. So you have a guy who basically got off more or less free for murdering people, somebody who couldn't pursue a lawsuit after he had been tortured, and somebody who is being charged with treason for telling the truth about the U.S. torture program. And then you had the State of the Union address where Barack Obama wanted to have an America where everyone is held accountable for what they do.
I want to talk a little more about the State of the Union address. Typically, the president gives it at the beginning of the year as a to-do list for Congress, his wish list for what he wants Congress to pass. This year, because it's an election year, it's also primarily a campaign speech, and more so than in the past, because Congress has been unable to pass anything in the last couple of years.
And specifically, the Republicans aren't about to allow Obama to pass anything during an election year.
Particularly in an election year, yeah. So basically, it was his campaign speech, his big first campaign speech in front of Americans. And he had some interesting things to talk about. So, of course, top of the list was jobs and job training. And mostly it was bennies for U.S. corporations. He wants Congress to change tax laws in order to encourage companies to bring jobs home. Of course, that is not going to happen. Tax law is not the reason why corporations are sending jobs overseas. They're sending jobs overseas for the reason that labor in other countries is cheaper. There are no labor laws in places like China. There are few, if any, safety rules. The materials and commodities that they need to produce products are located in other countries, et cetera, et cetera. It just goes on and on. A few tax credits are not going to encourage those companies to bring those jobs home. He also talked about more deregulation for business, a new trade enforcement unit to investigate unfair trading practices, basically aimed at China, which would involve more government spending, and to expand tax cuts to small businesses, also a public-private partnership between community colleges and big corporations, you know, just what students need you could argue, need more technical skills. But the problem when you let companies take over your community colleges is, will students get other skills that they need, like reading comprehension, civics, critical thinking, the other kinds of things that make people a model citizen in a democracy? not necessarily a plutocracy, which is what we're headed towards if we're not already in. He wants to free schools from standardized testing, which is a good idea, but also most of his educational stuff, it would involve much more government spending, expanding work study, more pay for teachers, extending the tuition tax credit. Those things all cost money. He did have a couple of other things in there, things that I found to be really pretty nauseating. One was he mentioned immigration reform, and then immediately, instead of talking about real immigration reform that would help people become U.S. citizens, putting out any specific proposal for that or anything, he then turned around and pounded his chest about how he's closed the borders with more boots on the ground than anybody previously. And then, of course, he also said, he said something that I found to be the worst piece of his speech. He said, "Tonight I'm directing my administration to open more than 75% of our potential offshore oil and gas resources." And then he went on to say, well, fracking, the process of extracting natural gas from deep rocks by pouring chemicals and doing deep drilling, which often disturbs the water table in an area and causes a lot of pollution. He went on to say, well, fracking is okay as long as companies tell us which chemicals they use. And that's our brand new environmental president. Of course, he threw a bone to environmentalists by saying he would allow clean energy development on public lands, which is environmentally controversial. There are many environmentalists who are arguing that public lands are not the place for clean energy initiatives. There are plenty of private lands out there who have already seen some disruption to their environment, who can handle having solar panels placed on them and handle having wind turbines, you know. You don't necessarily want to put solar panels in a fragile desert environment that's pristine, and you don't want to necessarily put wind turbines in the path of migrating birds. So even the little bone that he throws to environmentalists is very, very controversial.
Yeah, one of the things that I had flagged from the speech was a new task force to be set up to investigate the mortgage crisis misconduct, which, aside from being 3 or 4 years too late,
yeah.
He had tabbed New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman as the person to lead it. Now, this is, it sounds very good because Schneiderman, in his role, of course, the Attorney General of New York State has jurisdiction over Wall Street, and both Schneiderman and Elliot Spitz are before him, and Andrew Cuomo was Attorney General of New York State at one point too, have been pretty aggressive and much more aggressive than the feds have been,
yes,
in fact, in trying to prosecute financial misconduct on Wall Street. But in this case, by tabbing Schneiderman to a federal task force that's probably too late to do a lot of effective investigation, he's peeling him off from state level investigation, which has been more aggressive and more successful. So even when Obama looks to be doing something good, he may, in fact, it may be the whole thing of, you know, you'd rather have somebody like that inside your tent urinating out than vice versa.
Yeah, he's too late. And a lot of companies are going to argue double jeopardy because they've already been investigated by the SEC and the Department of Justice over these same issues. And the DOJ and the SEC have extracted settlements from a lot of these big companies like Bank of America, Citigroup, et cetera. And those companies are going to argue, why are we being investigated again by the federal government for the same thing? That's double jeopardy. So I don't know that task force is going to be able to do anything. In addition, in his speech, Obama asked Congress to pass the payroll tax cut, an extension of the payroll tax cut. And then by that time, you know, I was asking, okay, great. You know, here's all these things that the government wants to spend on. Where's the money going to come from to pay for all this? This is really
lots and lots of tax credits in that speech.
Yeah, lots of tax credits and lots of new spending initiatives. And so, you know, the point that everybody was looking towards is, how are you going to pay for this? What are you going to do to pay down the debt? You know, so he basically mentions two things. First, he mentions a peace dividend from ending the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Let's not forget, we're still in both countries. You know, the press may be saying, well, we're out of Iraq, but we have the largest embassy in the world in Baghdad right now. We still have trainers training the Iraqi military in Iraq. We are still there, and we still have a whole army full of civilian contractors in Iraq. In addition, we're still in Afghanistan and committed to Pakistan, committed to a war in Pakistan that is largely an undeclared war, and committed and have troops committed elsewhere, troops and weapons committed elsewhere in places like Yemen and Somalia, all part of the war on terrorism. So this notion that we have a peace, big peace dividend coming is a false one.
It's laughable, really. We're waging more war right now than we have in the history of the United States in terms of waging war in more different places.
Yeah. And it's not cheap. Even if there aren't as many troops there, it's not cheap because we're using a lot of high-tech weaponry that's very expensive. The second thing that he mentioned in order to pay for all this stuff is he just comes out and says, well, you know, people who make more than $1 million should pay their fair share of taxes, they should pay more than 30%. And then he just goes on from there and talks about something else. He gives no specifics on tax reform. He makes no proposals of what kinds of tax cuts should be repealed or what kind of loopholes should be closed. He mentions nothing about the tax rate on carried interest or on the capital gains tax rate, raising the capital gains tax rate. He makes no specific proposals at all, which is a real failure. It's a failure of governance.
Yeah. Even if you don't think that Congress is going to pass a proposal like that, you put the proposal out there and you make them not pass it.
You make it an issue.
You make the Republicans block it, and then you make it a campaign issue, especially if you're going to be running against Mitt Romney.
Yeah.
Instead, he took the cowardly way out.
Yeah, it's just remarkable.
All right. Moving on, this week's economic news.
Yeah, I want to talk about, speaking of Mitt Romney, I want to talk about Mitt Romney's tax returns, which were released this week.
Laugh track? Can we have the laugh track?
He released his 2009 and 2010 returns. In 2010, he paid $3.2 million on $21.7 million in income, which shows that he's not only a member of the 1%, he's a top member of the 1%.
This, mind you, is a man who has described himself as unemployed and who has not actually had a wage job in a decade.
Yeah, and his effective tax rate is 13.9% on that $21.7 million. He had no wages, but he continued to collect what's called carried interest. I mentioned that earlier from Bain Capital, where he did used to work. Carried interest is compensation, which really should be taxed at wage rates. It's compensation that is paid to usually hedge fund managers that is taxed at only 15%. It's a special tax loophole that hedge fund managers can declare their essentially what would be wages as carried interest, and it's taxed at capital gains rates of only 15%. Now, he also had lots of offshore investments, not just those ones that we mentioned last week in the Cayman Islands. He had investments in Ireland, Switzerland, Germany, Luxembourg, and also a very controversial Swiss bank account that held $3 million in cash, which
He's in old Europe?
Yeah, he's a member of old Europe for sure. His investment manager cashed it out and closed that account in a very interesting time, just right before Romney decided to run for office. He closed out his Swiss bank account, which makes you wonder, is it just because he was worried people would make an issue of it, or was that account being used to avoid taxes or for some other reason?
When was Romney not running for office?
And then I want to go on to talk, too, in economic news this week, a very important study was released this week by the University of Illinois and the University of Arizona showing that African Americans face discrimination in bankruptcy filings. Lawyers are much more likely to steer an African American couple into the more onerous Chapter 13 bankruptcy, where they have to pay back all their debts, instead of the more commonly filed Chapter 7 bankruptcy, where your debts eventually, or most of your debts eventually, get erased. Most debtors file under Chapter 7. And last year, 1.4 million people filed for bankruptcy. But African Americans, their rate of Chapter 13 filings were double the rate of any other filers. And this is holds the same nationwide, not just in the Deep South. So this discrimination is a national. It's a major problem here in this country. It's a it's a fact of racism in this country that is never discussed and needs to be discussed more. And the racism that continues in America is no more apparent than it, when you look at economic issues.
All right. Moving on to international, starting with Libya.
Yeah, Human Rights Watch, Doctors Without Borders, and the UN High Commissioner on Human Rights all called for a halt to torture in Libya this week. They pointed out that Libya's prisons are not all under the control of the transitional government. In fact, much of Libya remains outside of the control of the transitional government, including the streets of the capital city. The transitional government has set two deadlines for militias to withdraw from the capital city. Both deadlines have been widely ignored. Human Rights Watch and Doctors Without Borders have both documented many, many cases of torture of prisoners and detainees, and many of the victims, unfortunately, are sub-Saharan African refugees, pointing to some racism going on there
In fact, Doctors Without Borders has halted its operations in Libya. One of the dynamics that they had cited in halting their operations was that they would be called into the prisons to treat people who had been tortured so that they could be turned around and sent back to be tortured further.
Yeah.
And they just didn't want to have any part of that.
Yeah.
All right. Afghanistan?
Yeah. France announced this week under the conservative government of Sarkozy that it will be leaving Afghanistan by the end of 2013. That is 1 year earlier than the United States and NATO had previously announced they were going to be drawing down into Afghanistan. Then this raises the obvious question. If France can do it, why can't the United States and why can't the rest of NATO?
Yeah.
All right. And Guatemala.
Yeah, some good news from the international scene this week. Efrain Rios Montt will come to trial in Guatemala. Montt was a dictator from 1982 to 1983 for about a year and a half during the worst years of the civil war in Guatemala, a 36-year-long conflict that not many people remember nowadays. The UN Truth Commission that was established in the 1990s to investigate the civil war in Guatemala found that more than 200,000 people were killed in the civil war, mostly by government troops.
And mostly indigenous minorities.
Yes, and because the attacks were aimed directly at the Mayan population, they declared it a genocide, particularly since the entire civilian Mayan population was targeted. Montt is finally coming to trial because his immunity as a sitting legislator expired on January 14th. In addition, the current president of Guatemala, who himself was a mid-level member of the military during the civil war years, he has been very heavily involved in. He very much wants to pursue an anti-drug campaign in order to get funds from Washington, D.C. He's been told by the Obama administration that he needs to allow some of these human rights abuse human rights abuse cases to come to court. And so he's allowed Efrain Rios Montt to be charged. So there's some good news there. The downside, though, is that President Molina, who I just was talking about, was a mid-level member of the military during the worst years of the Guatemalan Civil War. There's been no investigation into his background, and there are plenty of people out there who haven't been charged yet and should be.
Yeah, and Montt himself has run for president several times in the past 15 years or so, and has not been successful, but he is still a formidably powerful political presence in Guatemala, so there's going to be pushback against this almost certainly.
Yeah, we'll see how the trial goes.
All right. Can you cover an update on Fukushima in about a minute and a half?
Yeah, just a quick update. The TEPCO, the company that owns the Fukushima plants, reported an increase in radiation from the plant from 60 million becquerels per hour to 70 million becquerels per hour in December. And this is in spite of the fact that Reactor 1 was showing decreased levels of radiation emissions. Apparently, Reactors 2 and 3 are giving off at least 10 million more becquerels each per hour just in the past month, which may be pointing to some failures in the containment system for those units, which we know at least one, if not both of them, have gone through partial, if not complete, meltdown. TEPCO stuck an endoscope inside reactor number 2, but they didn't release any results of what they saw inside that reactor, which makes me a little bit nervous. In the meantime, Japan's energy minister admitted on Tuesday that the task force that was charged with dealing with the nuclear crisis as it was unfolding right after the disaster, didn't keep any records, didn't keep any notes at all of their decision-making process or the decisions that they made during that time. So there is no historical record showing what the government response was to the Fukushima disaster, which I think is, I honestly, I don't believe that that's true. I'm guessing someone probably shredded all that in order to avoid some kind of terrible disclosure.
I don't remember seeing any of that on the evening news.
Oh, no. You have to read the Japanese news.
My theory is they took all that paperwork and plugged it, tried to plug one of the holes.
They probably They were desperate enough. They had to use everything.
Yeah. Talking as we do every week with Ja Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org. That's where you can find it. News, comment, comics, all kinds of good stuff. So check it out.